Once again, Russell Targ, his book, of course, his newest book, is called The End of Suffering. That's a very, very, very interesting title, I think, Russell. Is it really possible that we could end suffering? That's quite a claim.
It certainly is, and you had a good question at the top of the hour, why did I happen to write this book? And after I left SRI and the ESP program, I went back to my roots, which was laser work at Lockheed. And as a reasonably young engineer, I was very alarmed to see the people were dying very shortly after retiring from Lockheed. And each week I would get the Lockheed newspaper and observe many, many men who had retired at 65 would then die within the next 2 years, 67, 68 years old, which wasn't that far away from me. So I got 100 of the newspapers and quickly calculated that people were dying prematurely at odds better than 100 to 1. That is, a 65-year-old man who retired from Lockheed after years of service would be expected to live until 80 because he had avoided being shot by his friends in a hunting accident. He's not going to crash his motorcycle. He's not going to die in a war. Should have another 15 years of life ahead of him. And I was very concerned that these people were dying enormously prematurely. And I learned the same thing was happening at Boeing. In fact, Boeing and Lockheed and other aerospace companies had such a premature death rate that they were thinking about underfunding their pension plans because no one was living to collect them. So and one of my good friends died within a week of retiring. He said he wanted to smell the flowers, retired at 65 and was dead the following week. And what became clear to me is that people, army officers and long-term engineers, love their company and are very proud to have a business card that says Lockheed Engineer. And then you get to be 65 and they tear up your card, send you home to annoy your wife with nothing in your in-basket, and suddenly you're nothing. So the suffering and the premature death comes from the fact that you spend your life defending the story of who you think you are, and then that's suddenly taken away and you're nothing.
Now, that makes all the sense in the world to me. In addition, Russell, you might extend that because I know it's true that frequently when, I worried about this, when my wife passed away, I began sort of a downward spiral, a very, very fast downward spiral, Russell, and I have a feeling that if I'd kept going in that direction, I probably wouldn't be here right now. In fact, it's a very strong feeling. And I wonder if it's a similar kind of thing.
It's absolutely similar. There have been there's a lot of data for things like cancer and multiple sclerosis, which are often autoimmune diseases, that if you lose a beloved partner or lose your job, and frequently both of those occur, you're extremely likely to get sick or get one of these fatal illnesses because you're, in the case of losing a job, you lose your identity. So one of the things that I really emphasize in The End of Suffering is to discover who you are as separate from what you do.
Unfortunately, a lot of people don't do this prior, Russell, to an event taking place like retirement or losing a partner, particularly because you have no way of knowing usually when that's going to occur. At least I certainly didn't. So for those who don't have that advance warning, how can they begin immediately the process of recovery? And I mean real recovery, not just sort of still living, but really looking forward to life ahead and all the things that are going to keep you alive. How do you do that?
Well, the first step is mindfulness, finding a way to quiet your mind, stop the chatter, and moving into this spacious place where you give up living a life that's ego-centered, self-centered, and self-pitying, and move into the spaciousness where you feel generous and joyful. And it's critical to catch on to the idea there's more to you than just a physical body. So the idea of getting control of your ongoing chatter is very important. Another idea is to notice that nothing is really happening to you except to the extent that you give it meaning. That is, the Buddhists annoyingly say that nothing is happening, and what they mean is that nothing is happening except that you give it meaning, and it has meaning for you. It's an invitation to move from conditioned awareness, where you're focused on yourself, into a realm where you are spacious and helpful to other people. So what gives meaning to your...
Let me ask this, if I might. You've mentioned now Buddhism several times and the quieting of the mind. Is there anything within Buddhism itself, Russell, that that you identify with or you think is more correct than, for example, Christianity? Or is it simply the discipline of the mind, that the Buddhist practice that that you feel is useful in everything we're talking about right now?
People will differ on this. My opinion, that Karen Armstrong described Buddhism as a religion, and she's a great expert in religions, of course. I disagree. I think that Buddhism is a way of understanding who you are, and it does not require you to believe anything at all. The teaching in Buddhism is like a discipline, like a laboratory experiment. I can tell you to do this and do this and become part of a spiritual support group and live your life in a way that you're not cut off for people, but have spiritual support and move into the spaciousness. I'm not asking you to believe anything, but it's like a chemistry experiment where I say, if you will do this and then do that, come back to me in 6 weeks and let me know what you're experiencing. Are you feeling better? So I think that Buddhism is very, very helpful. They have a 2,500-year-old technology that tells people how to quiet their mind. If you look at the Dalai Lama, for example, almost everything that is said to him by a serious interviewer makes him laugh, because he recognizes that the interviewer really so misunderstands his own self and the world that the Dalai Lama hardly knows where to start answering the question.
Yeah, very interesting. So, again, recapping, there's nothing necessarily about Buddhism itself you must believe or you must practice or you must not necessarily become a Buddhist, but their practice of quieting the mind, their practice of self-knowing is of value.
There certainly is a difference between Buddhism and the worldwide Judeo-Christian view. Buddhism teaches that the divine or the spaciousness is within you. In the Judeo-Christian teaching, you tend to feel that God is omniscient and omnipresent and in heaven, and you're puny and small and down here, and your goal is to climb from down here to up there. The dualistic view, where you, the priest or the rabbi or some other intermediary will help you get from your meat and potato state to the divine state. The Buddhist argues that not only are you divine, the flow of loving awareness that's within you is who you are. You don't have to go to some other place. You already are a divine being, and you can experience that.